This podcast is intended for healthcare professionals only. Welcome to the first podcast in this series on diabetes care, which is brought to you as part of Diabetes Knowledge into Practice. I'm Professor Francesco Giorgino. I'm Professor of Endocrinology and Chairman of the Department of Precision and Regenerative Medicine in the Ionian area at University of Bari, Aldo Moro in Bari, Italy. Throughout the next 6 episodes, we'll be bringing you expert discussion on the latest news, views, and updates in diabetes care. You'll be pleased to hear that this educational activity is accredited for up to 0.25 AMA PRA Category 1 credits. To claim your credits, all you need to do is answer the post-activity questions at diabetes.knowledgeintopractice.com. There is a link to this in the episode notes if you are listening in a podcast app. This episode is supported by an educational grant from Novo Nordisk AS, who have no influence on the content or faculty. In this first episode, we are discussing highlights from the 83rd American Diabetes Association Congress. This year was a hybrid event with delegates able to join either in person in San Diego or online via a virtual event platform. The Congress featured over 200 scientific sessions and symposia and 1,400 posters. With such a wealth of exciting new studies and data on display, it feels almost impossible to select some highlights. However, joining me to do this is Dr. Richard E. Pratley, who is Samuel E. Crockett Chair in Diabetes Research, Senior Investigator and Diabetes Program Lead at the Advent Health Translational Research Institute and Medical Director at the Advent Health Diabetes Institute in Orlando, Florida. You can find links to his disclosures, as well as the abstracts and trials discussed in today's interview in the episode notes. So let's start with a panel session, Richard, who you chaired, which was titled Remission or Bust. Could you provide us with an overview of what was discussed and what the key takeaways were?
Yes, Francesco. First of all, thank you for having me on the podcast. This was a great session, I have to say. And it was great because we have some very knowledgeable panelists who brought their different perspectives to this discussion. So we had Professor Herzl Gerstein, Professor Sangeeta Kashyap, and then finally Professor Vanita Arora. And the session was unique in that we showed no PowerPoints at all during this whole session. We went 90 minutes discussing issues around remission of diabetes, getting input from the audience, and trying to create a lively discussion. And I think we achieved that. So this was a session in which we tried to talk a little bit about the definition of remission, how it fits into our current thinking of the pathogenesis of diabetes, our evolving treatments for diabetes, and how we might incorporate this into clinical practice. First, with respect to definition, we decided to rely primarily on the consensus statement on remission in diabetes, which was published in Diabetes Care a few months ago. What this states is that remission can be defined as having an A1C under 6.5% on no diabetes medications. So this is a fairly loose definition. Some people have more stringent definitions with a longer duration required. But the important point of this is that there are always going to be differences in opinion in how to define remission. The key thing, though, is that we have restored glycemia to almost normal levels and that people are able to manage this generally with lifestyle interventions. So the second question that we tried to address was how to best induce remission. And it was acknowledged that there are different approaches. One approach could be through lifestyle, like the DIRECT trial carried out in the UK. Another approach could be through medications, and there are several examples of either intensive insulin therapy or insulin combined with incretin therapy, and even surgical interventions. We know that surgery is the best approach to inducing remission in people with relatively new onset diabetes. 60 to 80% of people following bariatric surgery go into remission. But it's not a lifelong event. So we understand that this propensity to diabetes underlies all of the pathophysiology and is still there even when people are in remission. This led to a big discussion about, you know, whether or not remission is the correct term and what we are really seeing. But the bottom line is that the idea that people would be at relatively normal glucose levels off medications was likely to be a good thing for patients over the long term. Pressing the need for medications and treatment for diabetes into the future. And that might actually save them from developing complications. We discussed a little bit what sorts of support people would need when they're contemplating a remission program. Would it be diets, exercise, some combination, and where patients would get this type of support? Not all practices are capable of delivering intensive interventions like this. And finally, we discussed how this fits into our evolving ideas about the treatment of diabetes and in clinical practice. What we are evolving to is no longer just glycemic control in diabetes. That's, of course, very important to prevent long-term microvascular complications. But of course, we're trying to personalize therapy, having patients on drugs like GLP-1 receptor agonists and SGLT2 inhibitors if they have cardiovascular risk. But there's a whole large population of patients that don't have an indication for one of these medications that have early diabetes. And the question is what to do with this population. We're increasingly evolving towards the dual goals of both glycemic control and weight management. And this is in part driven by the fact that we now have much better tools for both lowering A1C and improving weight loss. This is in the form of both GLP-1 receptor agonists, particularly later generations that are more potent. And it's also the case with our new GLP-1 GIP dual agonists, and in future, possibly even triple agonists. All of these pathways offer A1C lowering up to 2% and weight loss that ranges anywhere from 10 to almost 20%. So this is a new era of diabetes management, and it really allows us to now think about taking patients with relatively early diabetes, giving them intensive glycemic control for a period of time, getting them started on a weight management program, potentially with pharmacologic therapy, pushing them into this phase of remission, and then following them long term. We agreed that there is a lot of outstanding questions in the area of remission. First, what is the best approach to inducing remission? Second, what do you need to do to support people who are in remission? Third, what are the potential benefits of remission? We assume that pushing the hyperglycemia into the future is a good thing long term, but we really have no trials to that nature. And fourth, you know, how do things like surgery and medical approaches, now that we have more effective drugs, compare in terms of inducing remission? So it was a very exciting session, lots of input from the audience. And I think this is a great way to kind of think about how the future is evolving for the diabetes management.
Thank you. That's really very important and exciting. And you have really just mentioned the importance of weight loss in this scenario in terms of an important component of management of people with diabetes. So weight loss is really a hot topic in diabetes care. And the Congress also included the publication of trials that investigated therapies to treat obesity in patients with type 2 diabetes. Some of these examples are the phase 2 trial with orforglipron, which is a daily oral novel GLP-1 receptor agonist, and the phase 3 SURMOUNT-2 trial that investigated tirzepatide in people with obesity and type 2 diabetes. So can you tell us more about these two trials and what they mean for clinical practice?
Sure. There were actually a lot of data presented that were in this space that I'd like to highlight. Development of a oral small molecule GLP-1 receptor agonist is really pretty novel. We do have an oral GLP-1 receptor agonist in the form of oral semaglutide that we know to be effective, associated with improvements in A1C and weight loss. And now that's been investigated both for the treatment of diabetes in higher doses, but also for the treatment of obesity, and some very promising results with that pathway. But this approach for small molecules is something unique. And it turns out that several companies are working in the space to develop small molecule agonists of the GLP-1 receptor. These molecules have the same properties as the peptidic GLP-1 receptor agonists. So what we saw at the phase 2 presentation of orforglipron is that there was weight loss in these individuals. There was improvements in A1C that approached that 1% to 2% range, depending upon the dose. And the side effect profile, the tolerability profile, was also quite similar to what we have seen with GLP-1 receptor agonists that are the typical peptidic ones that we are used to using. So these include things like nausea and, in rare cases, vomiting. So we believe now that these side effects are of consequence of engaging the GLP-1 receptor, and this will happen regardless of whether or not you're using a peptide or a small molecule. What was really encouraging about this phase 2 data is that they are getting results in terms of A1C lowering and weight lowering that is quite competitive with the peptidic GLP-1 receptor agonist. So I think this is going to be a great area for future development, and we see a number of companies working in this area. Moving on now to some of the other results from the ADA, there are a couple of results with tirzepatide that I wanted to highlight. One is the SURMOUNT-2 trial, which was a study of tirzepatide in obesity, the phase 3 study. In this particular study, patients with obesity, but not with diabetes, were investigated out to in excess of a year. And what we saw was excellent efficacy with body weight loss up to as much as over 20%. That's very exciting news, because previously we haven't had medications with this degree of weight loss. This is really the realm of surgical weight loss in the past. The side effect profile of tirzepatide in these patients was pretty predictable. There were some GI side effects, but overall they seemed to be tolerable, and most patients stayed on this therapy. So this is part of the registration package for tirzepatide for obesity. Those trials seem to be going very well, and we anticipate that within the next few months or year or so, that tirzepatide may have an indication for the treatment of obesity based upon these results and other. This again will allow us to change our paradigm for the treatment of obesity now that we have medications that are highly effective. Moving on, though, from this study, there was a mechanistic study with tirzepatide presented by Eric Ravison and Corby Martin. And in this study, they compared tirzepatide to weight loss with diet. And what they found was that with tirzepatide, there was weight loss, and that weight loss was accompanied by a decrease in energy expenditure. So this is pretty typical of what we see with all forms of weight loss. They weren't able to discern whether or not tirzepatide had any particular effect to blunt the weight loss induced decrease in energy expenditure. So this was a energy balance study. What Corby Martin presented was very interesting, in that he showed the effects on food intake. So he did both visual analog scales as well as a ad lib eating paradigm. And what he was able to demonstrate is large decreases in desire to eat, hunger, but they were not associated with any particular food macronutrient. So it seemed to affect both sweet as well as savory items. And what he demonstrated with the ad lib food paradigm is reductions in volitional food intake on the order of 600 to 700 calories. That's a pretty big effect on appetite. And this is probably one of the major explanations for the weight loss that we see with tirzepatide. I also want to highlight one last study, which was in the obesity and diabetes space. And this was a study of the combination of semaglutide, 2.4 milligrams, and a once weekly amylin analog called cagrilintide. In this study, they were investigating the effects of this combination therapy or the individual components in patients with type 2 diabetes. What they observed was very powerful reductions in hemoglobin A1C, again on the order of about 2 percentage points or so, with very nice and convincing improvements in time in range on continuous glucose monitoring. They also demonstrated that the combination of semaglutide and cagrilintide was associated with very significant weight loss. Now, this was a shorter term study, so we don't know what the true weight loss potential of this combination is, but I think this is something more to look forward to in the future for all our listeners.
Thank you. Thanks a lot for this comment as well. So let's now move to the last piece of information we would like to give to our listeners, which is in regard to the relationship between type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular events. And we know that in clinical trials, sodium glucose co-transporter 2 inhibitors, SGLT2 inhibitors, have shown reductions in heart failure, hospitalization, and therefore the guidelines recommend SGLT2 inhibitor use in people with diabetes and heart failure. But one real-world study suggested this is not being translated into clinical care. So can you tell us more about this, Richard?
Yeah, this is discouraging results, I have to say, but it's also not unique to this particular publication. There have been several publications recently that have suggested that the uptake of SGLT2 inhibitors and GLP-1 receptor agonists in patients in whom guideline-directed therapy includes these medications is less than optimal. In some cases, you know, it may be as high as 24%, but not nearly the level it would, to which it should be. The reasons for this are unclear, but it doesn't seem to be related to any particular country. This is more of a general finding. And I think it really reflects our medical practice. There is just sort of an inertia between the time that we identify new evidence, between the time that evidence is translated into guidelines, and we've now had guidelines for heart failure and cardiovascular disease for 3 to 4 years or so, and the time that these guidelines are implemented in practice. What this says to us is that we really need new approaches and tools to increase the uptake of guideline-directed therapy. This could be setting up special clinics for patients at high risk. This could be having ancillary healthcare providers like pharmacists or even advanced practice providers running these cardiovascular risk programs. They're all examples of where this has been done successfully. But I think the major task is not developing new evidence or new guidelines. What we need is to re-engineer our clinical processes so that more people can get on guideline-directed therapy and we can narrow the gap between patients with diabetes and non-diabetic individuals with respect to cardiovascular disease, chronic kidney disease, and heart failure.
Thank you. That's very informative. So this brings us to the end of the episode. In the episode notes, you can find a link to the Diabetes Knowledge Into Practice website, where you can claim CME credits for this episode and find lots more free resources to support your learning in diabetes. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review or rating to help other people find the podcast. Thank you very much for listening. And thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Francisco.